Welcome to the podcast of FEN's Virtual Forum 2020. We'll be looking at the highlights of Day 2, Sunday the 12th of July, and catching up with the people behind events. It was announced today that Professor Avishai Hennick has won the FEN's Kavli Network Mentoring Prize. We started by asking him how to find a good mentor.
My advice usually goes back to the advice that I received from my mentor. My supervisor during my PhD was Danny Kahneman, who received the Nobel Prize in 2002. And he said, just try to find someone whose research is really interesting, looks interesting, fascinating to you, and the person is nice, and you think that you will be able to work with him or with her. I think that these two criteria are still valid, but I would add one other thing. Ask other students. Don't ask faculty, just go to the lab, try to ask other students. I think that it is not only the mentor himself or herself, but the atmosphere that is characteristic of the lab, which is really important. I think that to the common stress that is characteristic of PhD studies, you add with at least several students that they start creating your own family. They marry, they have boyfriend and girlfriends. So this just adds to the stress of the PhD. And it is really very hard. One major thing for mentors is to know that you really need to help these guys, to listen to them, and they need to know that there's someone or other people in the lab, if the atmosphere is right, that they can turn to when they are stressed, when they want an advice, not necessarily an advice related to science. I mean, of course, science, but if there's something else, family and social life and so on, these are really important. If you have a good atmosphere, you are more assured or more feel comfortable, you are going, in my opinion, to produce better science. And also, aside from better science, we need to be human. This is probably also very important.
One nominee wrote, "Choosing Avishai as a mentor was not only a very good career decision, it was a life-changing event." We congratulated Professor Hennick and asked him, what was his secret power?
The short answer is that I really don't know. It is not clear to me. There are different ways to do the same thing. I mean, to do good mentoring, you don't need to behave in a very specific, certain way. I could say actually two things. One is that I'm willing to listen to them. The other thing is to create an atmosphere that conveys the feeling that you have people to lean on when you need it.
That was Professor Avishai Hennick, winner of the FEN's Kavli Mentoring Prize.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to give this presentation, even in this somewhat challenging times.
Next up, we spotlight Professor Erin Schumann's plenary lecture on local protein synthesis in neurons.
We have 800 billion neurons in the brain and probably 100 trillion synapses. And while a lot of neuroscientists focus their efforts on that big problem of complexity, the neurons and how they're connected, we are actually really fascinated just by one of those 800 billion cells. We're very interested in how a single neuron functions.
I actually started as an undergrad interested in learning and memory and in mechanistic studies, but did my honors thesis at the University of Southern California studying twins. So looking at identical and fraternal twins and looking at how much of their ability in learning and memory tests could be attributed to genes versus environment. And then did a big leap for my PhD to study learning in a very simple invertebrate animal, and started recording from brain cells in that invertebrate animal after it learned. And over the years have just become a lot more focused and more molecular. And our current fascination derives just actually from trying to understand how a single brain cell works. A single brain cell that has around 10,000 connections with other cells and has millions of proteins. And those proteins, which make the neuron work, just like they make all cells work, don't hang around forever. So they have a lifetime that's on the order of days. And brain cells, of course, are responsible for forming memories, for having information last in the nervous system. So it's very intriguing to us that the very thing that's supposed to hold the memory, the protein, is fleeting. How do you actually get a system where you can have long-term information stored when the elements that are storing it are turning over? And we've focused a lot in recent years on the idea that the proteins that are required and are used at brain synapses come from a local source. So if you can picture a neuron with a cell body, which is really tiny, most of the volume of the neuron comes from the finger-like processes that extend and are responsible for the cell talking to other cells in the network. That's 90% of the volume. And we discovered, along with several other labs in the world, that proteins can be made out near those synapses. So there's the protein synthesis machinery, and there's the messenger RNAs that are converted to protein. And we've been studying how those processes are invoked and used during synaptic function. So when brain cells are just talking to one another, but also when they store information. And we've found some really cool things over the years. Memory loss is, of course, associated with many neurodegenerative diseases. So there's certainly the angle that understanding how information is stored at synapses is important for that. There's also, in terms of mechanistic studies, the processes that we study, protein synthesis in neurons, turn out to be one of the fundamental processes in cells and in brain cells in particular that is manipulated and goes awry in some neurodevelopmental disorders. Like, for example, Fragile X syndrome, which is one of the leading causes of intellectual disability. That protein, the protein that's mutated in Fragile X syndrome, is an RNA binding protein, and it regulates the synthesis of proteins. And that protein is one of many proteins that is present and regulates synaptic translation out in the processes. And there are many other important synaptic molecules that have been described in autism disorders that have their messenger RNA out in the processes. So there's a huge number of loci and potential links to disease states that are very interesting. We ourselves don't work on diseases directly, but rather we view our role as really providing very basic information that people who do work in disease can then take advantage of, and they do.
Professor Erin Schumann, whose plenary talk today was about local protein synthesis in neurons. Professor John Fox is Editor-in-Chief of the European Journal of Neuroscience, and his special interest event is about how society-owned journals handle submitted papers.
The society-owned journals are run by scientists, for scientists, with an eye to helping to lift all boats, to improve work, to make sure that papers are treated fairly, rigorously reviewed, have a day in court, if you like, and receive thoughtful editorial input that's helpful. Let's say to a young investigator, they get good reviews back, good editorial input from the editors, senior people in the field, that'll help them to improve their work and to get it towards the point at where it's as accessible and has as much impact on the reader. And, you know, another aspect of these publishing workshops, this is not the first one we've run, is, you know, for youngsters, it can be a bit of a black box. You know, you get your paper together, you send it off, and, you know, there's a lot of urban legends out there about what happens to papers once they get out there to editors. And I think it's a little bit important for us to demystify that. You know, in the end of the day, when you send a paper to a society-owned journal, you're sending it to your colleagues, people who do the exact same thing that you do. They're not professional editors. They're people with their own labs who know the process. And so just to reveal how that works, what happens when your paper goes in, what are the key aspects of organizing a paper, what are important pointers to know about how to really craft a good paper that's going to do well in the review process. And then to reveal to people what happens, what the process is, how reviews are gotten together, how editors make decisions, the do's and don'ts, if you like. And I consider it, honestly, like the greatest honor of my career to be the editor-in-chief of the European Journal of Neuroscience. It's really rather fantastic for a European expat to you know, living in the States. It gives me such a strong connection back to my European community. So just that on a personal note, that's one thing. I became the editor-in-chief more than 5 years ago now, and I had a very long association with the European Journal of Neuroscience because I was a section editor before that time, for maybe 8 or 9 years before that. And when I took over as the editor-in-chief, I had a partner, Paul Bullen from Oxford, and we worked on it together. And, you know, the European Journal of Neuroscience is one of 350 or 400 journals that a neuroscientist can choose to send a paper to. It's a very different marketplace, if you like, than it would have been 15 or 20 years ago, when there was, you know, just a set of, you know, standard journals people sent to. And so it's really important to be competitive in that marketplace. And the society-owned journals have suffered because of, you know, the clamor for folks to get their papers into these glamour magazines and to go for these high impact venues. And one of the things that we have been really pushing hard is to make people understand how relevant society-owned journals remain today in the world of publishing and in the scientific world. And I just go back to something I said before, which is the key component of a society-owned journal is it's a journal for scientists by scientists. It's your colleagues. And that the revenue streams, that what we generate gets put back into our community. It's not a for-profit enterprise. The society-owned journals generate revenues that are then returned in the form of trainings and workshops and the meetings and so on. So you're essentially nurturing your own garden when you publish in the society-owned journals. I'm really pleased to report that the European Journal of Neuroscience is going from strength to strength. We receive upwards of 850 to 900 submissions a year, which is a lot of papers. And I want to make a big shout out to all our section editors and all our reviewers who do legion work in making sure that these papers are reviewed in a fast and efficient and thoughtful manner. And particularly now this year in 2020, we've seen a massive uptick in the number of papers coming in. So we're on schedule for well in excess of 1,000 papers. And in the last 2 months, in May and June of 2020, we've almost doubled the number of papers that we typically see in those months. Without, we don't know if that trend will continue. So the state of the journal is very healthy. The quality of the work continues to be high. And we get papers from every corner of the globe.
Professor John Fox, Editor-in-Chief of the European Journal of Neuroscience. Our next highlight is the plenary session by Professor Sheena Jocelyn from the University of Toronto. Well known for her work on engrams, Professor Jocelyn's talk was called The Amygdala and Memory, Recalling the Past and Imaging the Future.
We're really interested in how the brain encodes, stores, and uses information. We think this is a real key, fundamental, underlying question that is, I think, of interest to everybody, but we are especially interested in this. So we use a model organism, we use mostly mice, and we try and see which particular neurons in a mouse brain holds any one sort of memory. Collections of neurons seem to come together to form an engram, and this engram is the representation of a memory in the brain. And our lab and a bunch of other labs have really, I think, started to nail this process down a little bit. Of course, there are so many unanswered questions. But one thing that I talk about is exactly how this engram, how we represent an event in the brain, how this is formed, how different neurons are chosen to become part of an engram, part of this engram supporting this memory and not of this engram supporting another memory, how the brain organizes this information, and how that lets us remember some things together to link certain memories that sort of go together in our heads and to separate out some other memories that don't go together so well in our heads. So it's this common sort of organizational process, which we think lies at the heart of sort of organizing how we remember different things.
And we thought that maybe what we would try to do to try and search for the engram was to change the task a little bit. So here we're going to use auditory fear conditioning, really simple task. We place a mouse in a chamber. We give it a single tone shock pairing. Then anytime later, we typically use 24 hours. We test a mouse. So we put them in a new chamber and we replay the tone that was previously paired with the foot shock. And if a mouse remembers the last time I heard this tone, I got this foot shock, they'll show us this memory. And our index of memory here is the percentage of time that these mice spend freezing to the tone.
But we think that sort of how our memories are organized will give us really key insights into how we remember certain things and don't remember other things. And it's true, in mice, we use very basic, very emotionally charged memories because we give the mice one single training trial and they remember this event for their entire lives, about 2 years. So this is like a very big charged memory, but we think a similar process underlies non-emotionally charged memories as well.
Being of Scottish ancestry, Professor Jocelyn inevitably has mixed feelings about the online forum.
I was so much looking forward to going to FENS this year. Not only is FENS like a really great conference, it brings together a bunch of people in this wonderfully sort of crazy conference time, but I was really looking forward to going to Scotland. I really love Scotland. And now, because everything is virtual, because of circumstances, it really presented a challenge for me to sort of bring that sort of sense of urgency and that flair and that sort of Scottish fun to things. I was going to tape my talk, because I taped it last week, with a Scottish bagpipes playing in the background, because everyone knows bagpipes are very soothing. But I decided against that. But I think that it's been a challenge for me to sort of get used to the, I hate to say this, new normal, but I'm really enjoying it. I love seeing virtual talks. I love sort of seeing them when I want to, stopping, thinking about something, and then turning it back on, and really sort of keeping up with the vibrancy of science while, you know, staying safe and sort of learning how to incorporate this into a new way of doing conferences. I really think that FENS did an outstanding job, you know, pretty last second to get this together. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what people think of my talk and to seeing what everybody else is talking about. And this is like a really fun way of bringing the group of, you know, neuroscientists together without really bringing us together. Physically distant, but, you know, we're still interacting. Pandemic has been really hard, and sort of the pandemic also revealed a lot of basic inequities both in Canada and I think throughout many countries in the world, and that sort of really got me thinking and really doing some hard thinking on this and now trying to translate that thinking into some action. So it's really been a challenge, but I think a good challenge. I think, you know, change happens after challenge, and I think this challenge is going to force us all to change, and hopefully we'll take this opportunity to change for the better, change for the good.
Professor Sheena Jocelyn there, whose plenary lecture was called The Amygdala and Memory, Recalling the Past, Imaging the Future. Professor Kate Jeffrey is a member of FENS Care, the Committee on Animals in Research, and she's the moderator of this forum's CARE event.
And it's a group that has formed within FENS to advise on the responsible use of animals in research and the development of resources to support that research, and particularly public education. So a really big part of what we do is trying to communicate with the public about the importance of animal research, because of course that can be a very contentious issue if people don't understand why we're doing it and the importance of it for human well-being. Some of the important initiatives have been in the public domain, the domain of public education actually. So for example, we've put together a video that's aimed at children, really explaining the need for animal research and how it's done and why it's done. And it's done in a sort of a very friendly way. It's quite a short video, but really kind of useful. And we've put out a pamphlet too that explains what we do. We support scientists who are engaging with the public, and that includes scientists who have had difficulty with the public. So, for example, scientists who have come in for targeting, for attacks, or facing some type of hostility. That's particularly often the case for scientists who work on primate models of disease. So, for example, things like Parkinson's disease, because the idea of experimenting on primates is one that's very emotionally loaded for a lot of people who don't understand the disease or the way to scientifically address the disease. So I think, supporting researchers who have been targeted because of their primate research. And then another initiative that we've got going at the moment is a training grant for technicians who are working in research laboratories supporting scientists to enable them to travel to another lab to learn something about the latest best practice or latest techniques. So those are some of the things that we do.
The CARE event at the Forum has the dual role of spotlighting the work of the committee and also exploring specific issues.
So the idea of this event was to bring together researchers who are working on animal models of disease, animal models of basic science, and in particular who are using more than one type of species, so for example rodents and primates. So for example, Sam Solomon is one of the panelists, and I work quite closely with him at UCL and have seen him move his research from primates to rodents, to include rodents now. And he works on basic science, so how do these basic circuits work? And then the other two, Peter Janssen and Tara Spires-Jones, work on primate models of disease as well as basic science. And I think the thing that I'm looking forward to hearing about is, for one thing, what you get from cross-species comparisons of data, because we learn a very great deal about the core functions of brain systems when we study species that are somewhat divergent. So rodents and primates, they're both mammals, and similarly related to humans, but also quite different. So things that are similar about those species can tell us a lot about what's really core in these systems. So I'm kind of interested to see what the challenges are of trying to cross species like this. But also, I'm a basic scientist, and so I'm very always interested in how these findings from basic research can be applied to addressing disease. So I trained as a doctor originally, and was most interested in neurology and psychiatry, and became extremely aware that our knowledge of the fundamental processes is extremely limited. And so, 30 years on, it's really exciting to see how that's come on and how research in these species is helping to inform human health. And there have been some really remarkable progress made in domains like Parkinson's because of that research. So I think that'll be really interesting to hear about. And also some discussion about can we move away from animal models at any point in the future? Because obviously at some point we would like to be able to say we don't need to do that anymore. So at what point could we say that? At what point could we say we know enough now? Or how can we adapt our experimental methods so that it reduces the number of animals that we need to study, or changes the methods and so on. So I think it will be a really interesting discussion.
That's it for this time. Join us again tomorrow for Monday's highlights from the FENS Virtual Forum 2020. This podcast was made with the support of the Dana Foundation. The interviews were conducted by Shruti Muralida, Harry Potter, and Anders Jespersen. The music was by Kevin MacLeod, and the podcast was produced and presented by Malcolm Love. This is a FENS production. Find us at www.fens.org.